Bartimaeus, Chapter 47. The uproar that attended my master's unmasking of Henry Duval was as tumultuous as it is tedious to relate. For a long while, bedlam reigned. Word spread in ripples out from the magician's chamber, across the heart of Whitehall, and into the extremities of the city, where even the lowliest commoners wondered at it. The downfall of one of the great is always attended by much excitement, and this was no exception. One or two impromptu street parties were held that very evening, and on the rare occasions when they dared show their faces in the ensuing weeks, members of the night police were treated with overt derision. In the immediate term, confusion was the order of the day. It took an age to place Duval under arrest. This was through no fault on his part, since he seemed stunned by the direction events had taken, and made no effort to resist or escape. But the wretched magicians lost no time in clamouring to take his place, and for some while squabbled like vultures over who had the right to take charge of the police. My master did not take part in the affray. His actions had done the talking. In the end, the Prime Minister's lackeys summoned a fat afreet, who had been lurking sheepishly in the lobby out of the way of the golem, and with its help achieved order. The ministers were dismissed, Duval and Jane Farrar taken into custody, and the excited onlookers shepherded out of the building. The vast majority went quickly and without trouble. A few laggards were helped on their way by the application of infernos to their backsides. A number of pressmen from the Times, who were discovered making detailed notes of the magician's panic, were escorted to a quiet place, where their reports were channelled in a more favourable direction. Jessica Whitwell loitered till the last, shrilly proclaiming her part in Nathaniel's success, but finally she too reluctantly departed. The Prime Minister and my master were left alone. Exactly what passed between them, I don't know, as I was sent along with the Afreet to restore order in the streets outside. When I returned, some hours later, my master was sitting in a side room alone, eating breakfast. He no longer had the staff. I took the semblance of the Minotaur again, sat myself in the chair opposite, and tapped my hooves idly on the floor. My master eyed me, but said nothing. "So," I began, "all well?" A grunt. "Are we restored to favour?" A brief nod. "What's your status now?"
"Head of Internal Affairs. Youngest minister ever."
The Minotaur whistled.
"Aren't we clever?" "It's a start, I suppose. I'm independent from Whitwell now, thank goodness."
"And the staff? Did you get to keep it?" A sour expression. He speared his black pudding. "No, it's gone into the vaults. For safekeeping, allegedly. No one's allowed to use it." His face brightened. "It might be brought out in time of war, though. I was thinking maybe later in the American campaigns." He took a sip of coffee. "They've not started too well, apparently. We'll see. Anyway, I need time to refine my approach."
"Yeah. Like, see if you can make it work."
He scowled. "Of course I can. I just left out a couple of restrictive clauses and a directional incantation, that's all."
"In plain language, you fluffed it, mate. What's happened to Duval?"
My master chewed meditatively. "He's been taken to the tower. Ms. Whitwell is head of security again. She will be supervising his interrogation. Pass the salt."
The Minotaur passed it.
If my master was pleased, I had reason to be satisfied too. Nathaniel had vowed to release me once the matter of the mystery attacker was solved, and solved it undoubtedly had been, although I felt there were still one or two issues which defied ready explanation. However, this was no business of mine. I awaited my dismissal with easy confidence, and waited. Several days passed, during which the boy was too busy to listen to my demands. He took control of his department. He attended high-level meetings to discuss the Duval affair. He moved out of his old master's apartment, and using his new salary and a gift from the grateful Prime Minister, purchased a swanky townhouse in a leafy square not far from Westminster. This last required me to carry out a number of dubious chores, which I haven't time to go into here. They involved whitewash, wallpaper, and copious cleaning fluids. I say no more. He attended parties at the Prime Minister's residence at Richmond, held functions for his new employees, and spent his evenings at the theatre, watching abysmal plays, for which he had acquired an inexplicable taste. It was a hectic lifestyle. Whenever possible, I reminded him of his obligations.
"Yes, yes," he would say on his way out in the mornings. "I'll deal with you presently. Now, for my reception room curtains, I require an L of oyster grey silk. Make the purchase from Fielding's, and get a couple of extra cushions while you're at it. I could do with some Tash Kent enamelling in the bathroom, too."
He was no different here from 90% of other magicians. When not attempting to stab each other in the back, they spend their time surrounding themselves with the finer things in life. Luxurious pads feature heavily on their wish list, and it's always the poor jinni who has to do the legwork. Persian magicians were the most extravagant. We had to shift palaces from one country to another overnight, build them on clouds, even underwater. There was one magician who wanted his castle made of solid glass. Aside from the obvious privacy angle, it was a hopeless mistake. We built it for him one evening, and he joyfully took possession. Next morning, the sun came up. The walls acted like giant lenses, and its rays were refracted through with vigour. By noon, the magician and his entire household had been burned to charcoal crisps.
"Your 6 weeks," I said pointedly, "are almost up."
"Yes, yes, now I really must go."
One evening he returned home early. I was below stairs, supervising the tiling of his kitchen, but somehow tore myself away to press my case once more. To help carry out the job, he'd presented me with two foliots, which wore the semblance of orphan waifs. They were round-eyed and pitiable enough to melt the hardest of hearts. However, they were also inclined to laziness. I roasted them over a slow flame, and so won their prompt obedience. I found him in his dining room, an ostentatious space, currently without furniture. He was staring at the empty fireplace and the cold, blank walls.
"You need a proper pattern in here," I said. "Wallpaper to suit your age. What about a car motif or steam trains?"
He wandered to the window, his feet tapping on the hollow boards.
"Duval confessed today," he said at last.
"That's good," I said. "Isn't it?" He was looking out at the trees of the square.
"I suppose."
"Because with my magical powers I detect that you don't seem wildly satisfied."
"Oh, yes."
He turned to me, forced a smile.
"It clears up a lot of things, but most of them we knew already.
We'd found the workshop in the cellar of Duval's house, the pit where the golem was made, the crystal through which he controlled the eye. He worked the creature, no question."
"Well, then, today he acknowledged all that. He said he'd long wanted to expand his role, diminish Ms. Whitwell and the others. The golem was his method. It created chaos, undermined the other ministers. After a few attacks, with no solution found and everyone in disarray, Devereux was only too happy to give him more authority. The police were given more powers, Duval got the security post. From there, he'd have been better placed to overthrow Devereux in time."
"Sounds fairly clear," I agreed.
"I don't know."
The boy screwed down the corners of his mouth.
"Everyone's satisfied. Whitwell's back in her old job. Devereux and the other ministers are heading back to their silly feasts. Pin's reconstructing his shop already. Even Jane Farrar's been set free, as there's no evidence she knew about her master's treachery. They're all happy to put it out of their minds. But I'm not sure. Several things don't add up."
"Such as?"
"Duval claimed he wasn't alone in this. He says someone put him up to it. A scholar named Hopkins. He says this Hopkins brought him the golem's eye, taught him how to use it. He says this Hopkins put him in touch with the bearded mercenary and encouraged Duval to send him out to Prague to track down the magician Kavka. When I started investigating, Duval contacted the mercenary in Prague and told him to stop me. But Hopkins was the brains of the whole thing. This rings true to me. Duval wasn't bright enough to work it all out alone. He was the leader of a bunch of werewolves, not a great magician. But can we find this Hopkins? No. No one knows who he is or where he lives. He's nowhere to be seen. It's as if he doesn't exist."
"Perhaps he doesn't."
"That's what the others think. They reckon Duval was trying to shift the blame, and everyone assumes he was involved in the Lovelace conspiracy, too. The mercenary proves it, they say. But I don't know."
"Hardly likely," I said. "Duval was trapped with the others in the great pentacle at Headlam Hall, wasn't he? He wasn't part of that conspiracy. Sounds like Hopkins might have been, though. He's the connection, if you can find him."
He sighed. "That's a big if."
"Perhaps Duval knows more than he's telling. He might spill more beans."
"Not now. The boy's face sagged insensibly. He suddenly looked tired and old. On being returned to his cell after this afternoon's interrogation, he transformed into a wolf, overcame his guard, and broke through a barred window. And escaped? Not exactly. It was 5 floors up.
Ah.
Quite. The boy was by the great bare mantelpiece now, fingering the marble. The other question is the Westminster Abbey break-in and the matter of the staff. Duval agreed he'd sent the golem to steal it from me the other day. It was too good an opportunity to miss, he said. But he swore he had nothing to do with the resistance and nothing to do with breaking into Gladstone's tomb. He tapped his hands on the stone. I suppose I'll have to be satisfied like the others. If only the girl hadn't died. She could have told us more. I made an affirmative sort of noise, but said nothing. The fact that Kitty was alive was a mere detail. It wasn't worth mentioning. Nor was the fact that she'd told me a good deal about the Abbey break-in, and that a gentleman named Hopkins was somehow involved with it. It wasn't my business to tell Nathaniel this. I was nothing but a humble servant. I just did what I was told. Besides, he didn't deserve it.
"You spent time with her?" he said abruptly. "Did she talk much to you?"
He eyed me quickly, turned away.
"No. Too frightened, I suppose?"
"Au contraire. Too disdainful." He grunted.
"Shame she was so willful. She had some admirable qualities."
"Oh, you noticed those, did you? I thought you were too busy reneging on your promise to give much thought to her." His cheeks flushed red.
"I had little choice, Bartimaeus."
"Don't give me anything about choice," I snapped. "She could have chosen to let you die."
He stamped his foot. "I'm not going to have you criticizing my actions."
"Actions, nothing. It's your morals I object to."
"Still less my morals. You're the demon, remember? Why should it matter to you?"
"It doesn't matter." I was standing hands on hip, arms folded now. "It doesn't matter at all. The fact that a humble commoner was more honourable than you'll ever be is hardly my affair. You do what you like."
"I will."
"Fine.
Fine."
For a few moments there, we'd both been winding ourselves up into full-blown fury, ready to go at it hammer and tongs, but somehow our hearts weren't in it. After an interlude of him staring at a corner of the fireplace and me gazing at a crack in the ceiling, the boy broke the silence. "If it's of any interest to you," he growled, "I've spoken to Devereux and got Kavka's children released from prison. They're back in Prague now. Cost me a few favours to get that done, but I did it." "How noble of you." I was in no mood to pat his back. He scowled. "They were low-level spies, anyway. Not worth keeping." "Of course." Another silence. "Well," I said finally, "all's well that ends well. You've got everything you wanted." I gestured across the empty room. "Look at the size of this place. You can fill it with all the silk and silver you desire. Not only that, you're more powerful than ever. The Prime Minister is once more in your debt, and you're out from under Whitwell's thumb." He looked a little happier at this.
"That's true."
"Of course, you're also completely friendless and alone," I went on, "and all your colleagues fear you and will want to do you harm. And if you get too powerful, the Prime Minister will get paranoid and find an excuse to bump you off. But hey, we've all got troubles." He eyed me balefully.
"What a charming insight."
"I'm full of them. And if you don't want any more, I advise you to dismiss me on the instant. Your 6 weeks are up, and that marks the end of my current bond. My essence aches, and I'm tired of white emulsion." He gave a sudden curt nod.
"Very well," he said. "I will honour our agreement."
"Eh? Oh. Right." I was a little taken aback. In all honesty, I'd expected the usual bartering before he agreed to let me go. It's like making a purchase in an Eastern bazaar. Haggling is inevitably the order of the day. But perhaps his betrayal of the girl had lodged in my master's mind. Whatever the reason, he silently led me up to his workroom on the second floor of the house. It was decked out with the basic pentacles and paraphernalia. We completed the initial procedure in stony silence.
"For your information," he said cattily, as I stood within the pentacle, "you do not leave me entirely alone. I am off to the theatre this evening. My good friend Quentin Makepeace has invited me to a gala premiere of his latest play."
"How desperately thrilling!"
"It is."
He did a dismal job of trying to look pleased.
"Well, are you ready?"
"Yep." I performed a formal salute. "I bid the magician John Mandrake farewell. May he live long and never summon me again."
"By the way, notice something there?"
The magician paused with his arms raised and his incantation at the ready.
"What?"
"I didn't say Nathaniel. That's because I see you more as Mandrake now. The boy who was Nathaniel's fading, almost gone."
"Good," he said crisply. "I'm glad you see sense at last."
He cleared his throat.
"So, farewell, Bartimaeus."
"Farewell." He spoke. I went.
I didn't have time to tell him he'd kind of missed the point.